Yale game?
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah. Yeah, major and then retired and stayed out there to the Social Security Center. Now he's with the Federal Threat Task Force.
If you want to. Yeah.
Okay.
Could I ask everyone to take their seat, please? We're going to go ahead and get started since it's after 10 o'clock. There may be some people delayed in traffic. We do have some folks on the phone, and we'll introduce them in a minute. Welcome to the second SLTPS meeting for 2013 and the sixth SLTPS meeting overall. As you probably can see already, there's a change in the agenda. I am not the chair, John Fitzpatrick. Due to unforeseen circumstances, he was called away to other meetings that came about yesterday and apologizes for not being able to be here. We'll carry on without John. As you know, this is a public meeting, so we are subject to the requirements of the Federal Advisory Committee Act. The meeting is being recorded, and the minutes will be made publicly available. As always, the minutes are. You see, we have microphones around the tables, and we ask that if you do want to say something, we have enough cord to position the microphones near you. If there isn't one, please identify yourself and your affiliation so that we can adequately get that information for the minutes. And we don't seem to have anyone back there yet, but we do have a microphone, anyone that's not sitting around the table. And on that point, if your agency is not coming and you're from, for example, Defense Department, feel free to sit up at the table in their spot. And so if you do have a comment from the floor, I ask that you use the microphone in the back. And also, anyone making a presentation, the podium to my left is what we'd like you to use for that purpose. Just want to make note of, before we do the introductions, there's Terry, just getting started, right on cue, as we haven't done the introductions.
Okay.
So, a couple of changes to the committee membership I wanted to mention. We have William Pelgrin here, who's the president and CEO of the Center for Internet Security, who became an SLTPS member on June 20th. Welcome. Glad to have you here. We also have Glenn Bensley, who's on the phone, and we'll do those introductions in a moment, who's the Assistant Director of Security and Emergency Planning Staff from the Justice Management Division of the Department of Justice. He replaces James Dunlop as the Justice Department representative. And one member who's not with us any longer is Gerald Wheeler. He was our representative for the tribal community. He's actually no longer employed as executive director in the Office of Public Safety of the Seminole Tribe of Florida. So we'll be soliciting from the SLTPS PAC in the coming weeks requests for nominations for a new member. So now what I'd like to do is have everyone introduce themselves, to include invited guests and those on the phone. And in fact, I'd like to start with those folks that are on the phone first. So if you would, identify yourself, and if you are a member, we may have at least one person joining us who's not a member. So, Colonel, would you like to go first? Hello?
Colonel Marcus Brown from Maryland State Police.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Elena Duggan with the DHS Office of Intergovernmental Affairs.
Welcome.
Glenn Bensley, Department of Justice, and also Lori Ellison is here with the Department of Justice.
Welcome, Glenn and Lori. Okay, welcome, Lindsay, as a member also. Anyone else? Okay, it sounds like that's what we have right now on the phone. So I'll start here. This is Greg Pannoni. I'm in for John Fitzpatrick. I'm also the designated federal officer for this committee.
Terry? I'm Terry Suit, and I'm a Secretary of Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security for the Commonwealth of Virginia and the Governor's Homeland Security Advisor.
Bob Scarab from ICU, I am the alternate VFO.
Richard Hollis, FBI.
Debbie Lebo for CIA. I'm sitting in for Joe Lambert.
I'm Clyde Miller, I'm with BASF Corporation, and I'm working in the private sector.
Bernard Stapleton, Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
William Greco, Nuclear Price.
I am Bob Kolaski of DHS Integrated Task Force.
Welcome.
Good morning, Booker Bland, Defense Security Service.
Mark Beckerel, Department of Energy.
Neil Duckworth, Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Will Parkman, Center for Internet Security, Chairman of the State ISAC.
Leo Massian, State Department.
Charlie Rogers, sitting in for John Young, DHS.
Kate Connor, Department of State.
Joe Taylor, back there from ISU, helping out. Joe, could you hear us okay on the phone?
Yes.
Good. That's good. Okay, we have meeting folders. Everyone has the blue folders. For those of you on the phone, I don't know if you have the handouts or not.
So, Bob, did we get them, the handouts?
The ones that we do are sent
to okay.
Dialing in.
Okay. Okay, so I know some of you have the handouts. At least, that informed us that you were dialing in. So we have the meeting agenda, the minutes from the last meeting, and the slides for a couple of the presentations that we have on today's agenda. Also, yesterday, we emailed a copy of the 2012 National Network of Fusion Centers final report. It's a 90-some page report, so we didn't print it out for this meeting, although we did provide the cover sheet with the URL link to the report that are in your folders as well. So I highly encourage you to take a look at that. This is the second year that they've reported out, and there's a lot of interesting data there. Now what I'd like to do is to ask Ms. Suit if you would like to make any comments as the vice chair representing the SLTPS entities.
The only thing, you know, really right now that's kind of hot on our radar screen, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence apparently is proposing pulling DHS INA agents out of the fusion centers. That would be extremely problematic for the fusion centers and for the states. I think, you know, as you all know, that work with our state partners, both local and state, fusion centers are the conduit for all classified information. That's the belly button that the federal government utilizes in order to pass information to the state actors and the locals. But even more importantly, that's where the HSDN terminal is located. And having an INA agent there means that our agents have an opportunity, our analysts can access that huge wealth of product database information inside those classified databases, and can then develop products that are important for the state and important for the local based on, you know, what they find in there that's applicable. So just having a call-to-call conduit from the FBI or from DHS to share a specific piece of information that's just been discovered, while that's helpful, not being able to access that classified report database and develop our own analytics is very problematic and could really hurt the capabilities of both our state and local law enforcement and policy partners. So I would just encourage the administration to please, you know, watch that closely. We really can't afford to lose those INA agents. They're critical to the state and local intelligence operations.
Okay.
Okay. Sounds like a funding issue maybe causing this.
This is the first time I've heard of it.
Well, if you had asked that if you would take that back, Charlie,
yeah, we're getting that through the National Governors Association. Our private sector partners, too, that we share information
with,
because it's not, I mean, again, it's not just, hey, real time, here's a piece of classified information. This is about developing products, taking products that are already out there and developing products that help us better prepare for potential threats. And it also is an issue dealing with, trying to nominate special events to the DHS special event data call, trying to nominate critical infrastructure. We need to be able to go into those databases and see the trends, see what reports have already been developed out there, and determine, based on those reports, what the threats are, and also for the THIRA, in order for the states and the UOCs to develop the THIRAs and input that data back to DHS. Those are the Alina, help me out. I don't remember what that acronym stands for, but that's also a requirement of the UOCs and of the states in order to continue to justify grant dollars. We've got to have, I mean, this is like asking a grad student to write a research paper without being able to access peer-reviewed research products already out there. You've got to have those existing reports in order to create your reports that then support your policies and your actions going forward. So it's just critical to us. I can't underscore it.
So it is. It appears that, I don't know much about it, but it has a cascading effect. It's a cyclical issue to get these pieces of information out to many other parties that it would be relevant to. So we'll ask that the vice chair representing DHS look into that for us. Thank you. And on that note, Charlie Rogers here representing the vice chair for the federal government, as you know, on the agenda has some remarks to make there, but he'd like to briefly make a remark at this time.
Yeah, I just want to take an opportunity because Carol Moorhart is here today to give the first presentation on the SLTPS database, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank Carol and OPM writ large. There's a lot of staff members there. There's people in JPASS who worked on this to work through an interface for the state and local database, and Jim Pleahall's here, and other stakeholders participated, and it's really been a long, hard process just to negotiate the kind of database we wanted and how we were going to get there and take in the concerns of both the federal concerns and the capabilities. And OPM has worked really hard to get us. We're not there yet, and I don't want to take away from her presentation. But we've made a lot of progress to move forward, and there's still work to be done to develop the database. But I just wanted to take an opportunity to thank her and everybody else for the progress we've made so far. So,
okay. Yeah. Thank you, Charlie. It does look promising, and we'll see more as we see the presentation on that. Next, I'm going to ask Bob Skorat, who's our alternate designated federal officer for the meeting, to address any old business issues. Bob?
Yeah, just a couple of administrative things. The minutes from the last meeting, which are in your folder, they were finalized and certified on March 20th, 2013. And I think most of you know about the issues with the sequester. Our executive order permits reimbursement of travel expenses, but because of the sequester, we're currently unable to do that. So, many members are participating via teleconference. Also want to note that some of the SLTPS members have come here on their own dime, if you will, and sacrificed a lot of their time to get here, and we very much appreciate that. Among them, Terry and Mr. Pelgrim, our new member, and Mr. Miller. So we greatly appreciate that. And lastly, there were no action items from the last meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Yep. As you know, these are difficult times for all of us as far as budgets, and it looks like it's going to be that way for the foreseeable future, so we have to be as creative as we can be to continue the mission. Next, I'm going to ask Carol Moorhart from the Federal Investigative Services to come up to the podium and give us an update on the security clearance data issues and the OPM central verification system. And there's a lot of good work, as Charlie mentioned, that's going on, and Carol's going to give us an update and the next steps way ahead on how this is coming along. Carol.
Can everybody hear me? I want to thank you for having me here today. I'm happy to be here for a couple of reasons. The primary reason is we've made a lot of progress, as Charlie has said, in our SLTPS working group, and we still have a little ways to go as far as additional enhancements, but we've come a long way since when we first started this initiative. And second of all, it's always nice to be above ground. Some of you may not know, but I work out of Boyers, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour north of Pittsburgh, and we work underground in a mine. So any chance to be above ground is always a welcome change.
I've been there. It's an impressive place. I'm sure a couple others have been there as well. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it is, but it's always nice to get above ground.
Yeah, visit's okay. I agree.
And on that note, I just want to add my colleague and friend, who's usually by my side, Trisha Prasnikar. She wasn't able to come here today. She's been involved. She has a week-long training class that she's attending, so she was unfortunately unable to be here. But she is the creator behind this presentation, so I wanted to give her credit for that. So we'll go ahead and move on to the presentation, and feel free, if you have any questions, just raise your hand. You don't have to wait till the end of the presentation to ask any questions. Okay, you can go ahead and move to the next slide, please. Basically, just an overview. We started this project officially. The working group commenced at the beginning of this year, January, although there were previous unofficial meetings prior to that time, but the actual working group was established in January of 2013 this year, and our primary goal was to flesh out requirements as how best to depict and display the SLTPS view for various users. And the next slide. This working group, which we call the CVS Stakeholders Group, it was well representative by various agencies. It wasn't just a sole one agency that put these requirements together. It was very much a collaborative effort, as you can see. There are several agencies such as OPM. We had DHS. We had ODNI. There was Department of Justice, DOE, and Defense Manpower Data Center. Everybody at one point or another was able to attend these meetings, provide input, questions, concerns regarding the requirements that we were gathering together for this initiative. It ended up that we built this initiative into two phases. Certain requirements became available to us. We kind of grouped them together, and the first initiative, as we call it, the first phase was phase one. And this phase is basically comprised of getting the clearances of those SLTPS users into the system, which is an ongoing initiative. And another aspect of phase one was to be able to identify those data fields that the working group deemed necessary for this initiative. So we identified the data fields, and we are going to put them into the central verification system, or better known as CVS. So one of the objective was to get these fields into CVS and also to be able to enable the agencies who are participating in this initiative to be able to populate those data fields. And we're currently using the mechanisms that are currently in place.
Could I interrupt and ask those on the phone, if you haven't already, would you please mute your phone? We're getting a lot of feedback here.
on our end, and it may be causing others on the phone not to hear each other. Thank you.
Okay, as I was saying, one of the primary components for phase one was to identify the fields necessary to be added to CVS and also to enable those agencies to populate those various data fields. And we're utilizing the current methods that are in place right now for agencies who are furnishing data into CVS, and that is for them to be able to add their clearance through their PIPS agency menu, as well as to be able to do a mass upload of those data fields. Another component for phase one is to be able to produce a report for the agencies that are actively involved with the SLTPS to be able to come up with a listing of those clearance holders. Now, phase two, which the requirements, we've gathered the requirements and those were delivered to our developers back at the end of May. What phase two is to create a whole new user role for CVS, and they're called or known as the security liaisons, and these individuals actually work at the fusion centers. So this represents a whole new user role for CVS. Currently, we have primarily one CVS user role, which is basically your security officers. And then we do have some back-end suitability adjudicators from DOD who also access CVS. But this represents a whole new user role. And what that's going to entail is to be able to give a limited view back to these users of CVS to be able to verify or confirm whether the individual that they're querying has a minimum of a secret clearance.
Excuse me, I want to ask Carol. So that goes across all the fusion centers, so a security liaison could check on the clearance status of virtually anyone in the SLTPS community? Is that what's envisioned with this?
If that individual whom they're querying, if they are in the CVS database and or JPass database, as long as they're in there,
okay,
that should give them a result back. They shouldn't get a no record. Now, if their clearance is not in CVS or if their eligibility is not in JPass, then you should get a no record back if they're not in there.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Now, the next screen, and this is an enhanced screen of the one of the current screens that we have in CVS. This is actually a clearance detailed screen. When you query CVS by putting in a subject social security number and his last name, and there is information in CVS, there's various tabs, the investigative tab, polygraph, clearance tab. When you click on the clearance tab, the first screen that you come to, it's a summary detail screen. It'll show any clearance that was reported through CVS for that individual. And then you can drill down into specific clearance, and this is where this screen comes up. So it's a detailed screen. And what Tricia's showing you, the highlighted fields, those are going to be the new fields that we're adding to the current clearance detail screen. So what you can see at the top, the first field that's highlighted is the affiliation. We're going to be collecting the affiliation. And the next screen to be highlighted is the eligibility level. Throughout our discussions, we deemed it necessary to add another eligibility level. The current eligibility levels that CVS is capturing, basically it mirrors the clearance levels, and that is, I'm sorry, the clearance types, your top secret, your secret, confidential, Q&L. And I'm sorry, that is the clearance levels. So we're adding the SCI as an additional clearance level. The next field that we want to focus on is your sponsoring agency. We're going to add that field to the clearance detailed screen. And what we did here was this field is going to be open and it can be populated by any agency wishing to populate it, not just the SLTPS agencies. And that's why we opted to put it on this detailed screen. And the next field that's highlighted is the access. And throughout our discussions, we decided that we're going to add an additional access of NATO. And another thing, another change here is that currently right now the access agencies can choose one of the following. It's not a combination, but this one, the change here will allow agencies to select multiple accesses. And then just the other field that's highlighted, and it's a minor change, is in front of the SOI slash agency, and that's the agency that's granting the particular clearance. We're going to put the word granting in front of it. Now, the biggest change to this screen will be over to your right. There's going to be a link that says view SLTPS info, I believe. I can't. Info. Anyway, if the user wants to, the user can click on that. And that's going to bring up a pop-up screen. And this is where you're going to find your sector and the program office and also additional information of where the individual duty region is actually located. And just an FYI, these screens, we developed these screens for our programmers to give them an idea of how we want the fields to be laid out. In the previous screen, it's like I said, it is an existing screen. But as far as like the color and the font, that may be subject to change once our transformation has been completed. But these are the web-based screens that we came up with and were approved and gave to our developers to work on. And as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to give you guys an overview of where we're at today and how far we've come with, how far we've came with the SLTPS working group and some of the next steps that we're going to be needing to work on. And one of the things is as far as the training plans, there's two types of training or two different levels of training. As the first one indicates, you have existing CVS users out there, and they're going to see those screens that I just showed you. So they'll be needing to be trained on that, and what the training will consist of, that will be to be determined. And they also, the next training that's probably going to be more extensive are going to be your security liaison, the SLTPS community. And once we get... Once phase two gets deployed, as far as introducing those new user levels, there'll be some training that will need to take place prior to the deployment, of course. And that's, I have a couple questions actually for Charlie. I didn't know one of the things I wanted to find out. I know in our previous working groups we talked about a training initiative that was tentative, and I don't know if it's still tentative for this fall, November.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that.
Okay.
We have a regular workshop, or maybe it's irregular now because of funding, that INA has funded in the past, and we just don't know the funding from INA. I mean, there's talk of what, early 2014 possibly as a workshop?
Funding is there, they're just trying to help locate a location, so it's there sometime maybe November-ish.
Okay.
But we have other training initiatives that we can...
Okay.
If the workshop doesn't happen, we will figure out how to train these security liaisons.
Yeah. One of the reasons we were just, we were asking is because we will know to be able to have our slides and screens ready, for the training initiative for phase two.
I think it's early 2014 or probably the most.
The earliest?
Yeah, accurate.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. And also the last bullet on here is testing and deployment by OPM staff. Currently we are in target to deliver phase one the end of this year, December of 2013. So there will be testing prior to deploying that into production. As the basic timeline indicates, we are on schedule to deliver phase one, which is by December 2013, which will give the current CVS users the SLTPS pop-up screen. And the next one, as far as we're still working with CIO, it's coming up with the schedule for the time frame and the timeline to be able to deliver phase two. And as far as future initiatives go, during our working group, we had discussed on a couple of occasions the need for a meeting roster. We'll probably revisit that to see if that's still a viable requirement and to flesh that out in a little bit more detail. The second bullet, just a reminder to those agencies who do have clearances, SLTPS clearances, to please make sure that they are in CVS.
On that point, is this something that the DNI, as a security executive agent, could help foster and promote, through a memo or something? We have DNI is here today. Is that something for consideration to make? Because that's important that, if you have this data, but if it's not entered, it's not going to be as fruitful as it could be.
You can always put it up there and ask. I know there is an initiative we're looking at trying to combine CVS, JPass, and get those into scattered castles and have one centralized repository for clearance information. So definitely it's something we can look at.
That'd be good. Thank you.
Okay, the next one is basically, as I mentioned earlier, preparing the stakeholders to populate the new CVS data fields. Once we deploy this, agencies will be not required, but they should be able to go in and populate the various fields for the SLTPS. And I do believe, and Charlie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I know we had a discussion early on, but I believe that all the fields that we are creating, they're optional fields. None of them are mandatory.
Well,
I mean, we'd like agencies, of course, but yeah. I believe we discussed this before. And
I know the DHS will populate the fields, and we would hope that other federal agencies do. Yeah, I guess it's optional in that sense. But
right.
The fields are designed, for people who don't know, the fields are designed to identify different private sector affiliations and to enable the federal community to reach out and identify critical infrastructure people who are cleared. So
there's no real downside. I mean, it's all upside.
No, it's all
up. Having
it just may be that some agencies don't know, may have cleared them for a different purpose and don't know their affiliation. They may not deal with them in that role.
Yeah, and the reason I mentioned that is because I didn't want agencies to think that if they don't know all of the information, then they're not going to be able to pop. It's not all or nothing as far as populating.
No, we want to get all the data in there that we can and not hold it up.
Okay. On the last bullet, as far as we touched upon earlier, as far as getting these security liaisons trained to be able to utilize CVS as it's being designed for them to access, so that will be a requirement or that's something that we'll be talking about in the future as we get closer and closer to deployment and also to the tentative training dates of November, I would imagine. And just lastly, I would like to, if anybody has any questions now or in the future, that you can contact either myself, I'm the functional lead over this project, or my colleague, Tricia Prasnikar, from Requirements and Policy. And on that note, does anybody have any questions for me?
Just one I have. You had that timeline, Carol, chart, and it wasn't clear. Do we have a... Looks like April, or is it further out that phase two target completion date? Do we have an approximate completion date for phase two?
No, we don't. That is currently the project or the schedule. The project schedule is currently being worked on by our CIO. So we don't have, I don't want to even give you a date because we don't know that yet. We're asking for it as soon as possible, as soon as they complete it. I think, Tricia, we just put that in there as a placeholder.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions they want to ask on this topic? All right. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Very much. Let's move along here then. Our next presentation is going to come from Bob Kolaski. And I said that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is another area of criticality that's going on. As some of you may know, or all of you know, there was an executive order 13636 on improving critical infrastructure, cybersecurity, and also a presidential policy directive 21 on critical infrastructure security and resilience that were recently issued, I think earlier in this year, February timeframe or so. There's a lot of information in there, a lot of timelines for things to happen. Some of those dates have already come and more will come. as Johnny Carson used to say, more to come. And so with that, let me have Bob go on up, and yes, please.
And are there ways to move the slides from here?
Will, you have?
Okay,
he'll,
great.
He'll advance for you.
Hello to everyone. I know a number of you, but for those of you who haven't met, I appreciate you having us here and having me here. Wanted to give you a quick update. We were just saying that the president issued these two policy documents in February of this year and assigned about 20 specific tasks to the departments and agencies. Wanted to give you an update on what we've already done, what we've already completed, what we're still working on, and also, you know, have a little bit of a dialogue of where we're going in addition to doing the deliverables within the executive order and the Presidential Policy Directive 21. So just to ground us, these are some fairly, the first slide is fairly generic, but what we're trying to emphasize as we talk to, as we're out talking to folks is how important the critical infrastructure mission is across government, that the across industry, across working with state and local governments. The critical infrastructure itself in the security and resilience of critical infrastructure is essential to, you know, both national security and homeland security. It's essential to public safety. We recognize that our infrastructure needs to have the ability to operate and operate for our economy to work, and it's key to community resiliency, et cetera. And although the government has a clear and important role to play related to critical infrastructure security and resilience, it is a role that is often, the federal government's role is certainly often in a supporting role. The majority of the critical infrastructure in this country is owned by private companies. There's a significant portion that's owned also by state and local governments. There's some interesting ownership structures in place, particularly around some of the locally regulated industries. And so because of that, this has to be a team effort. It has to be a collaborative effort. We have to, in some ways, have the ability to change the way that we share information, we work amongst each other, between each others, and that we do joint planning and joint priority setting. And we really are trying as an administration and a department and a federal government to embrace those concepts, and as we do this work that the president has assigned us in the executive order in PPD 21, to really do it jointly, collaboratively, to recognize that we are not in charge in a lot of these areas. These are areas where we are part of the team, and because of that, although we have to get the work done that we've been asked to do, it has to be done in a team manner. For the next slide, please. Let me talk for a second about give you a high-level overview of Executive Order 13636 and PPD 21. You noticed in my first slide I didn't mention the word cybersecurity, although the word cybersecurity is very key to what we're trying to accomplish here. The President and the administration made the decision to release these two policies on the same day, simultaneously, and the Department and the White House have worked together. We're implementing these jointly. That's because we truly believe that although cybersecurity and addressing the cyber challenges are a key part of the risk we face as a nation, they are part of the all-hazards risk environment, and we cannot afford to separate the cybersecurity mission from the all-hazards homeland security mission. We've heard over and over from state and local governments and businesses that cybersecurity is part of their overall enterprise risk management approach. It's part of the capability decisions they're making in the face of all these challenges, and we have to think about these two issues holistically and in a connected manner. And so all of our critical infrastructure policies that we're putting forward take into account the importance of protecting our cyber systems and networks, but also in the context of protecting our systems and networks from all hazards, from terrorism, from extreme weather, the effects of aging infrastructure, et cetera. The policies emphasize the terms security and resilience, which replaced the Homeland Security Presidential Directive 7, which was focused on infrastructure protection. So at a high level, you know, this is just a continued evolution to thinking about security and resilience as the end state goal as opposed to protection, particularly as you throw resilience into an end state goal. It's all about the ability for the services and functions to continue to be delivered even if a system is down or is under duress. And it's all about communities' ability to operate even in the face of duress, extreme weather, et cetera. Cybersecurity presents an interesting challenge to that, and I'll be talking about it a little more. So with that, let me go on to the next slide. Specifically, what's in... So if you grant what I was saying before, really what we're talking about through these two directives is a all-hazards risk management approach to addressing the major challenges facing our nation's infrastructure in a public-private collaborative manner and using public-private partnerships. And that's not just one public-private partnership. There are public-public partnerships, there are private-private partnerships. There's a multitude of partnerships. Information sharing is at the core of our ability to execute those partnerships and work together because we're really trying to achieve a unity of effort in this mission where, again, we're not necessarily anyone's always in charge, but we're all working toward the same direction. So that's the strategic vision of the policies. Within the two documents, the president asked the departments and agencies to do some specific things, and I'll give you an overview of those, and then we can provide you some updates on where we are in achieving those. The first is develop a technology-neutral voluntary cybersecurity framework. So the National Institute of Standards and Technology within the Department of Commerce has the lead for doing this, but they will tell you and have said publicly that the private sector has to be in the lead in developing the cybersecurity framework and that the owner-operator community needs to be in the lead. This is a place where we want to develop a cybersecurity framework that makes sense for owners and operators of critical infrastructure to adopt, to demonstrate their commitment to cybersecurity, the steps they've taken to secure their networks, the dynamic risk management characteristics that they have in place on their own systems to address the cyber threats. NIST is working hard, and we're working with them to develop that cybersecurity framework in collaboration with owners and operators. I'll talk more about that in a second. The second bullet refers to the fact that we do recognize that investing in cybersecurity and adopting the cybersecurity framework is a business decision. It's a business decision made by whether it be made by the government as a business decision for government systems or by private industry for their own systems. Undoubtedly, owners and operators of critical infrastructure have a commitment to cybersecurity. We recognize that, and there are good business reasons to invest in cybersecurity. The cybersecurity framework imagines more investment and more confidence in the cybersecurity practice that put in place. And the government does have the ability perhaps to incentivize and change the cost-benefit equation of adopting cybersecurity framework. So we are, through the EO, studying what incentives are available to promote adoption of the cybersecurity framework. That's a second area. The third area, which I know is of interest to this group, is related to information sharing and particularly increasing the volume, timeliness, and quality of cyber threat information. You've all lived and heard the complaints about getting different information from different sources, not knowing whether the information is trustworthy, getting it too late, getting it in a manner that doesn't allow action to be taken. We're continuing to enhance our own internal processes and work with owners and operators to make improvements in that direction. While doing so, both in terms of information sharing and other cybersecurity practices, we think it's important to incorporate strong privacy and civil liberties protections into that. That's a key pillar of the executive order. I'll talk a little bit about the activities we're taking there. And finally, the executive order does talk about as the cybersecurity framework gets developed, it talks about exploring the use of existing regulation to promote cybersecurity. It does it in the term of, first of all, to be clear, there will be no new regulation associated with the executive order. It does it in places where if there are existing regulations in place, like with the CFATS program, which is run out, the chemical program, which is run out, DHS, regulatory agencies are asked to study whether the cybersecurity framework will meet the regulatory requirement already in place. CFATS, for example, has a risk-based performance standard around cyber. And so we'll look at whether the cybersecurity framework and adoption of that can allow companies to have a single way to comply with the regulations. So we're hoping it will streamline some of the regulatory process. We're also studying whether there are existing regulations in place that would impede the adoption of the cybersecurity framework. PPD 21, so EO 13636, I like to say, is really about taking and promoting immediate risk management actions in the face of the cyber threat, and PPD 21 is both learns from the lessons of trying to do that through EO 13636 and the work we're doing, and strengthening and evolving the foundation that's been put in place in critical infrastructure policies, you know, certainly since 9/11 and HSPD-7 and the initial National Infrastructure Protection Plan. It asks us to continue to evolve those practices in the face of all hazards, to get better at situational awareness capability to address both physical and cyber risk, with a particular focus on interdependencies and cascading impacts of infrastructure not working, and helping us collectively understand how to make infrastructure more resilient and make decisions in the midst of incidents that get our infrastructure up and working or communities up and working in a more timely fashion. It also asked us to evaluate and mature the public-private partnership. As you heard me say, public-private partnerships are such a key part of how we do this work. We've learned a lot of lessons working together within the government, between DHS and state and local governments, between feds and state and local governments, between feds and private sector, between state and locals and private sector. And let's take those lessons to bear. Let's see if our model's working, and let's continue to enhance it. One way we'll do that is by updating the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, which we're in the process of doing right now. Finally, PPD-21 asks for a comprehensive research and development plan to be completed by February of 2015 on critical infrastructure security and resilience. Next slide, please. I'm here as representing the Integrated Task Force, which is a body that DHS stood up to engage the entire interagency, to work at an interagency level and engage the entire critical infrastructure community. I've said it already that it's important that everyone has a seat at the table and is part of this process. We've tried to take that very seriously, get stakeholders involved early and often in the work that we're doing, be out talking as much as possible and getting feedback in all the work. You know, that's particularly important in things like the cybersecurity framework discussion and information sharing, where the intent of information sharing is to get information in the hands of owners and operators and for us to have the process in place to get information from owners and operators. Next slide. So where are we? The deliverables, there was a set of deliverables. The first one were due June 12, 2013, and were 120-day deliverables. I mentioned the incentives. We made some recommendations on what incentives the federal government might have the ability to put in place to promote businesses adopting the cybersecurity framework. Analyzed functional relationships existing within the critical infrastructure community, and we, of course, I can't read from here, so I'm trying to read my slide. I think I got it. We also put in place a process to make the Enhanced Cybersecurity Service Program, which is a threat information sharing program that DHS has at a classified level, to put in processes to make more classified threat information available to the whole critical infrastructure community and all 16 critical infrastructure sectors via our relationships with commercial service providers, CSPs. So at 120 days, we have improved our classified information sharing programs, working with industry and through commercial service providers. Something else that we did is we published instructions within DHS and DOJ, and D&I did something similar to make put in place processes to do a better job of sharing unclassified cyber threat information with owners and operators. We did this. The DHS, the D&I's already got a tear line policy in place where basically there's the ability to take intel-derived information and create tear lines to get cyber threat information at an unclassified level out to owners and operators. DHS, we did an analogous policy related to share lines. This is classified information that was not created via intelligence or via intelligence collection, but is information that previously been collected. There is now an explicit requirement within DHS to do whatever possible to make that information available to those who need to know at an unclassified level, so that it's more of a need to share than a need to know culture. So that's some of what we've accomplished within 120 days. 150 days, we've worked with owners and operators and others to identify critical infrastructure where a cybersecurity incident has potential to cause catastrophic national or regional impacts. That's a lot of words. At one level, how you can think about that is taking some of our previous criticality work and bringing it into the cyberspace, where we now understand better where cyber incidents can cause critical levels of consequences. We have a little better sense of the critical infrastructure in the cyber nexus of critical infrastructure, but I use the word catastrophe intentionally. The executive order uses the word catastrophe intentionally because what we studied was really a high threshold. Are there areas where really cybersecurity incidents can cause catastrophe? Unfortunately, we found there are. But it's not a long list. It's nowhere near as long a list of infrastructures that we've identified previously in our criticality efforts. There are certain sectors where there's heavy reliance on cyber systems, where they're greatly interconnected, where the pace of the service delivery is almost instantaneously, where cyber incidents can cause really significant economic consequences. In doing that, we also found that there's a lot of resilience in a lot of the sectors of critical infrastructure. So that was sort of the good news part of it, that although there's the potential for really bad things to happen, we've made a lot of progress in creating resilient systems, and we have no doubt that the systems where really bad things can happen, vulnerability protections are put in place and backup systems, and there's good risk management there. Also at the 150-day level, we submitted a report evaluating the public-private partnership model, how well it's working for critical infrastructure security resilience. We found that the existing model, which is largely captured in the National Infrastructure Protection Plan and involves cross-sector councils and sector coordinating councils and government coordinating councils and ISACs, information sharing advisory groups, and state and local partnerships, the state and local government coordinating council, regional coordinating councils. All those structures have brought a lot of people to the table, have done a pretty good job at doing joint planning, of identifying priorities, of getting information out. So our top line finding from evaluating the model is that the model has the potential to work. We don't need to come up with a different model for how critical infrastructure owners and operators work with different levels of government. We have to continue to reinforce and use the model. Like any model, there are opportunities to strengthen it, continue to build trust, do a better job of communicating within it, using it fully for things like joint planning, priority setting, capability development, joint investment. So we've made some recommendations how to enhance it, but fundamentally we don't anticipate that the National Infrastructure Protection Plan is going to anticipate, and we don't recommend creating a bunch of new structures. One of the things we do want to do with the National Infrastructure Protection Plan is make a better linkage to the National Preparedness System and the PPD8 work, and so we'll be doing that. Finally, at 150 days level, we did put in processes, and I saw from your notes from January that Bridger McGaugh was here in January, and he talked a little bit about our private sector clearance program and how it was just getting back online in January of this year. It has been up and running, since late winter, and we have put in processes to expedite the provision of security clearances, particularly to those owners and operators in the private sector of organizations who own the most critical infrastructure, where incidents can really have the most deleterious effects. So we have improved our own processes to expedite clearances. We've set up a process where we have criteria to more quickly evaluate private sector officials who've been nominated to get clearances, to make quick decisions. We have three principal mechanisms for taking in nominations for private sector members. That includes our protective security advisors, which are a DHS Office of Infrastructure Protection asset, as well as our sector-specific agencies and DHS's own sector specialists. So we think we can smartly and quickly evaluate whether there's a need for private sector members or private sector individuals to have clearances and make decisions and, when possible, get them into the process. That's important, but it should always be discussed in the context of we'd also like to get as much information as possible about threats and phone mitigation measures out in an unclassified manner, in a controlled but unclassified manner. And so we don't want the improvement of our own security clearance program to just be seen as a call for let's just get more and more people into the cleared, and then let's all operate in the cleared space. We'd like to push as much out of the cleared space as it's feasible while maintaining information protections as appropriate and separating information that has to remain at a classified level. We have in the executive order calls for an evaluation of privacy and civil liberties impacts for any changes we're making based on the executive order. So we do have our privacy and civil liberties offices looking at the clearance program and other things, the criticality work that we've done to make sure that privacy and civil liberties are properly baked into that work. They've been involved from the get-go. They will be filing, both DHS and other departments and agencies will be filing reports on privacy and civil liberties impacts of the work that's been done. I'll end and then take any questions that you all have. I'll just end by talking about sort of some of the things that are coming next. I talked about the National Infrastructure Protection Plan and the rewrite. That's due in October of this year. Most of the heavy lifting will be done in August. We have the beginning of a concept for the new NIP, and we'll be writing in August. We've been asked to develop a near real-time situational awareness capability for critical infrastructure to promote situational awareness and decision-making during incident management. We'll be demonstrating that in October of this year. We're working with DOJ and DNI in particular to continue to do a better job of or to build systems and processes to track the dissemination of cyber threat information, where it's going, the EO also talks about tracking the disposition, which we take to understand, was the information useful? Did it help support decision making? So we're working with DOJ and DNI on that, as well as the rest of the interagency. That's all part of us having a better understanding of whether our two-way information sharing with owners and operators is working and supporting decision making. And finally, we'll continue and are continuing to focus on working with NIST on the draft cybersecurity framework. The draft's due in October, and the final one's due in February of next year. DHS has the responsibility to take the cybersecurity framework and work with the critical infrastructure owners and operators, the specific sectors, to promote adoption, make sure that it makes business sense, that it's leading to a higher level of risk reduction within industry, and that it's something, again, that the industry thinks both helps lead to higher levels of cybersecurity practice, but also allows enough for flexibility and innovation so it's not so determinative that adopting the cybersecurity framework has you saying that, oh, we've handled the cybersecurity problem, we're off to the next thing, because that's not the nature of the cybersecurity problem. So we want to make sure that the framework is flexible and improves over time. So I think that's the major movements within the EO and the PPD. I've tried to emphasize from the get-go that we've got to get the deliverables done, but the purpose of this is not to do the deliverables. The purpose of this is to build and strengthen the ties across the critical infrastructure community so that we continue to have an ability to work together to solve the critical infrastructure challenges we face. We have to put in place the government processes, but government processes are an enabler but not sufficient to achieve all this, and we have to recognize that and collaborate throughout. I have more slides, but I'm not going to waste your time with them. So, thank you, and if anyone has any questions or thoughts, I'll be.
Questions?
I've got a question. So this is really good to hear, because you know, there's a lot of chatter about cybersecurity. It seems like yesterday I was chairing our Virginia Commonwealth Secure Commonwealth panel, and there was lots of talk about what are we doing for cybersecurity, and I know in the National Capital Region, there's always a lot of angst over cybersecurity. We're looking at doing a cybersecurity senior leader seminar for Maryland, D.C., and Virginia folks in the NCR coming up. We had to reschedule it because of the potential deratio last month. But this is really great, but it also seems like there are some disparate activities going on cybersecurity, and I'm wondering if you're plugged into all of them. For example, there's a big push for the National Guard to become cyber warriors and kind of own that response to cybersecurity events. Are you all tracking on that? Is there any discussion there? Is that a good idea, a bad idea? It's being pushed by the Senate and also by some governors through the Council of Governors.
Sure. So Individually, I can't speak with any authority on that question. I think I can assert and we're pretty confident the DHS and our cybersecurity and communications folks are involved in conversations with that. There's always a danger that these disparate activities get out of alignment with each other. We're trying to commit, and the reason we created this integrated task force is we have all the interagency at least at the table, and it's a place to collaborate with the private sector. So hopefully and the White House has done a good job of bringing in the Interagency Policy Committee to make sure that we're all trying our best to talk from a federal perspective, to tell the same story and talk using the same language. In terms of the National Guard question, I probably should just punt on that for now.
Well, I would encourage you that
we'll go back and we can get an answer, and Elena's on the phone.
Elena, the Council of Governors, the 10 governors appointed by the president to kind of represent all governors on DOD and National Guard issues, they're meeting on August 4th in Milwaukee, and a big portion of the agenda is cybersecurity and this National Guard effort to become the first responders for all things cybersecurity. So to the extent that you all could maybe share with the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Todd Rosenblum for Homeland Defense over at the Pentagon, he's the POC for DOD on this whole FCOG, Council of Governors. To the extent you guys could talk to each other, that would probably be real helpful.
And it's our Undersecretary or Acting Undersecretary Suzanne Spaulding will be at that COG meeting as well. And Todd used to be at INA.
So you guys all know each other. That would be really great. It's always hard when the governors come home and it's like, okay, we have this new thing that sounds really great.
Clearly DHS doesn't envision a world. We use our CERT teams or cyber emergency response teams to provide support to critical infrastructure owners, offers as well as state and locals. But we certainly don't have the capacity to be everywhere around that. So we are not the answer to cybersecurity response writ large. If the government is investing in more capacity and capability, that we need more capacity and capability. We just need it to all be done in a smart way and in a coordinated way.
I'd also like to sort of piggyback on that a little bit. There's a lot of moving parts at all levels of government, federal, state, and local. But some of what I see in here raises for me the Controlled Unclassified Information Program, which NARA, ISU, were the executive agent. And one of the things that struck me was the voluntary nature of the framework. And while we're not there yet with the CUI program, and there's some in this room, at least I know one, that works CUI for their agency. I don't for my agency, but I know enough that we are developing in conjunction with the community, particularly NIST, a set of standards that they already have that will be minimum standards for controlled unclassified information, and it will not be voluntary once agencies have so designated their CUI, and that will be done formally through a CUI registry which already exists that has categories and subcategories. So that struck me a little bit. I don't know the level of interconnectivity with. I see you have an integrated task force and quite a number of working groups. If not already, I think it would be worthwhile to get our CUI folks connected with at least one or more of these groups. But in addition to that, I would add, there's so many things going on. The DOD, pursuant to the National Defense Authorization Act for 2013, was required to identify at this moment just for clear defense contractors. Okay. Everybody, as much as possible, we apologize for the technology glitches. First time, so we'll do the best we can.
I appreciate it. It's much better now.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think someone on the phone thinks they're muted and they're not muted. So maybe the folks on the phone could all check. But one of you is not muted. We're hearing lots of things going on in your office.
That's a good point, yes. Please, if you haven't already, please mute your phone. Anyway, I was going to mention that there was a requirement in that NDAA Act for DOD, at least for their, at this time, for all clear defense contractors, to
it creates what's called covered systems, and these are not classified systems. You may be familiar with this. And it requires certain reporting requirements. And to get to the point where we are, we've been working very closely with them. They've developed for the information that will be covered in these covered systems a category called DOD Controlled Technical Information. And that will be a CUI category, which then will require, not voluntary, but require these controls that we work with National Institutes of Standards and Technology under Commerce. So it's still unfolding. There's a lot of moving parts. CUI itself is not implemented at this point. But I think that it's good that we're having this discussion so that if not already...
And I was remiss, because this is a generic slide deck, I was remiss at mentioning one of the deliverables that's actually due in August, which is out for interagency review right now, which is baseline data and systems requirements to promote interoperable sharing of physical and cyber risk information. And that's an area where we've laid out some technical requirements as well as some critical information requirements and security requirements, where this is what you need to have in place if we want to promote interoperable exchange of data, which helps get you to situational awareness. So that's something that I can share with certainly the feds here, that it's out for review. It's out for the IPC review. The IPC is a joint cyber domestic resilience review. And I think that would be a place where we can say something about what kind of security handling practices and requirements should be put in place around to promote your ability to receive and share critical information.
And I'll mention one other recently that just came up, which they hadn't plugged DHS into, but we've encourage that, and John Young is going to be involved. And there's a Spectrum, I'm not that familiar with it, but this Spectrum program that is being run out of the Office of Science and Technology, OSTP, within the White House. And it, too, involves unclassified but sensitive information. And there's certain requirements that there's a number of agencies that are involved. But for some reason, they had left DHS out. It was unintentional. And so we're having John Young from DHS get involved there, because that, too, plays into this area as well. But thank you very much. Sure. Anyone else have any questions for Bob? Yeah, Leo.
Leo Massiano, State Department. Going back to your cyber emergency response team, CERTS, concerning the skill sets, the... expertise, the baseline capabilities. Do you have a model in place for the CERT team?
We do. I can't speak to it with any detail. But we have that model, and I'm happy to get that to you and connect you with that. And also from a state perspective, this is perhaps one of our richest areas of international engagement, where we've provided technical assistance to other nations as they've stood up their own CERT teams. And we've set up processes to share information with what folks are seeing in other, internationally in other countries.
In terms of the global collaboration, Dan, is that an emerging area, the skill sets that needed?
Probably, I think. Not knowing exactly how you're defining emerging, I would imagine that it's something that wasn't the principal skill set that we thought as we started to build the structure, but we've learned how important that is.
For crisis management, for instance, certain law enforcement techniques, computer forensics, things like that that may not be typically used in a domestic crisis response, or maybe they are.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay, very interested in what you're...
Yeah, let me give you a card and follow up on a certain question.
Okay, anyone else?
Bob, I would like to make sure that this body gets connected to the integrated task force, because we have a big interest in any activities that relate to access to classified or the sharing of classified.
So we did put up the working groups. At this point, the information sharing working group, which is right now focused principally on cyber threat information sharing, because that's the deliverable, is I think the best place to plug in. But we've had conversations of making sure that in focusing on the immediate deliverable, we recognize the larger issues and
Yeah, and I'm connected peripherally to some of this, but it'd be helpful to get more directly.
Yeah, it's true. Charlie, I'll send you the information following this meeting, and you can disseminate.
Okay, I'll send the name.
Thanks.
And I'll pass your info, like I say, on to our CEO,
okay,
folks.
Okay.
But yeah, there's plenty of opportunity to get involved, but we recognize that there are a lot of working groups because we have to come to you rather than you come to us.
All set on that?
Good.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Really good.
All right, next, moving on to Mr. Rogers here. He's going to brief us on updates from the Security Management Division with respect to implementation of this SLTPS security program. It's all yours, Charlie.
Okay. I just wanted to bring you up to date on some of the initiatives we've been moving forward on. I think I've probably spoken at almost every PAC meeting we've been at, but I wanted to talk about the security compliance review program. I'm going to talk a little bit about self-inspections, some of the support activities with security liaisons, and a little bit about the HISN network and some changes there. I'll try not to go into too much detail because I don't want to bore you with too many facts, but in the previous meetings, we talked about setting up a security compliance review program. We conducted last fall, I think, three pilots. Virginia Fusion Center was one, Delaware was another, West Virginia was another. Since last fall, we have conducted a total of 16 security compliance reviews to the state fusion centers. We did two last week in Connecticut and Vermont. We expect by the end of this fiscal year to have done 22 security compliance reviews, and I just wanted to bring you up to date on that. We're fairly pleased with ourselves because we've been working pretty hard to make this happen. We've been going out to fusion centers. The implementing directive associated with this executive order came out in March of 2012. It included additional responsibilities that the security liaison would be taking on. It formalized their responsibilities. It enabled us to say, this is what you need to do. There's a policy document here. So we've been educating the security liaisons for a few years, but since the implementing directive came out, we've been working with them to take on new responsibilities. And the compliance reviews have really been a process for us by which we learn their operational context, what they're doing, how they're managing classified information. And secondly, it's an educational process where we train them to pick up those duties that they may not be doing. What I can tell you is what we found out from visiting the fusion centers is that we have found no significant problems in the fusion centers, nothing that would raise our concern the classified information was vulnerable. What we found out is that there were minor things. I call them minor. I mean, we immediately addressed those that we could. But things such as we have a requirement that they test their alarm on a quarterly basis, and some of them weren't testing their alarm. So we got them on board to test their alarm. There's a few places where they check the clearances of anyone who goes into the secure room, but they don't keep a log or a signature log. So we're talking, or maybe combinations had not been changed in the time frame that's required. But these were not major things. Overall, we found that the security liaisons are taking their job seriously, that they and that the leadership is taking their job seriously. So that was all very good news to us. We learned some other things, and this may relate to a little bit about the intelligence and analysis people who are deployed. The security liaisons tend to work very closely with the INA intel people. Because the rooms are certified to the states and the rooms are in state facilities, we focus on the security liaison to make sure that they're bellying up and doing what they want. But we found that there's a partnership between the intelligence and analysis folks from DHS who are deployed, and the security liaisons. So in many instances, they're like partners. Although we try to hold the states accountable because we certified the rooms to the states and the INA folks are being hosted there. The other thing we found out is that
you know, at different fusion centers, there may be 11 cleared people. Some of them may have 50 cleared people. We provide them with HSDN accounts, but it's really only a handful of people who are accessing HSDN on a regular basis. Not all cleared people there. They may have accounts, but they're dormant or they don't use it. And primarily, the INA intelligence analysts are the people who are really retrieving and searching through HSDN to find pertinent documents that support the mission requirements of the fusion centers. So that was new to us. The other thing we found out is we require that anybody who has an HSDN account be trained in derivative classification. Because there's always the possibility that using that account, they will derivatively classify. And they're pretty good. The numbers are, we're up in the 90-some percentile of people who've done the training. We also found out that we have not thus far identified a single fusion center that has created a derivative classified document. That the derivative classified documents that are created in the fusion centers are done by the INA intelligence analysts. Now, the fusion centers are creating a large number of law enforcement sensitive or for official use only, soon to be CUI information in the fusion centers, but they're not doing derivative classification. So those are interesting things that we found out. The other thing I would say that as part of our evaluation, we look at the holdings, the classified holdings in the fusion centers. For the most part, of the ones we've been to, and we've been to some pretty large fusion centers, all the fusion centers we visited have HSDN. They generally have a limited number of classified documents that they're holding in their security containers that they feel need to hold on to for reference. Since they have not created any derivative classified documents, we did review those documents, and there are some discrepancies in the markings of those documents. Of course, we've collected that data, but it's really on us. And by us, DHS and other federal partners who are creating documents, we're not 100% accurate in our own marking of our classified products. So I just throw that out there.
Charlie, did the review take on a perspective of not just classified, but the sharing of information in general, both inclusive to the location, the fusion center you visited, but also externally? I know that when I looked at that, and I haven't read the whole thing, that National Network of Fusion Center report, there was some data in there that talked about exchanges of information outside of the fusion center. I'm just curious if it did, and what did you come away with in terms of where are we on a scale of 1 to 10 from their perspective?
We didn't focus so much on how they individually operate and share. I know that there's a robust system between the fusion centers and regionally. We were more focused on, one, management of this of the secure room and the HSDN and all classified materials there, management of how they manage meetings, how they verify clearances. One of the common findings where we found out that there weren't enough courier people, authorized couriers. So whenever we found a place and we said, do you have any couriers? And they said, we have one person, we have 60 cleared people. We said, you need to identify a few more couriers. But for the most part, the classified is being centralized in the fusion center. They don't seem to be transporting it out in a way. I think the INA intelligence person will go out and brief senior executives in state government and law enforcement in the states. I can't say that the fusion center people don't do that, but I think the INA people do it more than the fusion. But we were really focused on just the how they're managing that classified piece in the fusion center, and they're doing a pretty good job. There is, you'll see in the fusion center report, and I'm not briefing the report, but there is a section on security. There is a high turnover of security liaisons. I think there's a high turnover of fusion center directors for the most part too. And I'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing quickly to address that. We mentioned that there's a workshop that had been paid for by INA. I think the last one was in late 2011. There were hopes to have one this year. There are funding issues, which everybody is affected in the federal government. But when there is going to be a workshop, certainly CVS will be briefed there. It's an opportunity where we get a large number of security liaisons for 2 or 3 days, and we train them. What we've been doing in the absence of having that workshop is we're doing monthly training sessions that started in May, I think, and we've trained 44 security liaisons with our field security coordinators, kind of a teleconference webinar. We have a PowerPoint, and we have, I think, a total of 8 will be carried out by the end of the fiscal year. So we're doing that. INA does a quarterly call-in to all the security liaisons, and we sit in on that and participate with that. So we're reaching out to them to try and keep them, you know, trained and up to par. We have some products that we've created, and I'll be jumping ahead. I'll talk about that in a minute when I talk about the HISN website. So we're doing things to keep them trained in the absence of the workshop. Let me switch gears. If you have any questions on that, let me know. Otherwise, I'll move into the security compliance review. Part and parcel of the security compliance review is the self-inspection program. That's what I meant to say. And what we're doing with that is anywhere that's had a security compliance review this year, and that'll be 22, we expect, by the end of the year, that will count as a self-inspection. We had done a couple of pilot self-inspections that I'd brought up earlier at a previous meeting. What we are doing now is we've created a self-inspection checklist. We revised it after having input from other stakeholders and selected security liaisons. We've got a derivative classification log. We decided also to create a report document to support the self-inspection program. And right now our field security coordinators are reaching out to all the security liaisons to make sure those locations who have not or are not scheduled to have a security compliance review will do a self-inspection in accordance with EO 13526. So we created the checklist, but we also created this report format in part because the new report requires that we not only say that we did the checklist, but that we identify what the discrepancy is and we identify how we're going to address that discrepancy and best practices. So we're working with them that when they do the checklist and they tell us that there's something wrong, we want at their level for them to tell us what they're going to do about it. We still have a responsibility to assist them, but we're trying to get them engaged. So we're hoping that we'll have close to 100% of participation in self-inspections for this year. And I'll probably get with you, Greg, later on to sit down and talk about what our products are and how best to package the report to you all so we get it right. The other area I wanted to talk about a little bit, let me see. I talked about the support to the security liaisons. The HISN website. Now, we have a HISN website. It's a Homeland Security Information Network website. It's a state and local security administration. A little bit about HISN in general is Homeland Security Information Network, I think, has 12,000 users. It has multiple websites. It has websites for the private sector, for state and local. There's law enforcement-specific websites. There's first responder websites. There's intelligence and analysis websites. We have a very small piece, which is the security management website. We initially focused on getting security liaisons to join that website to post security products up there. We're beginning to expand. We want to expand the membership to get cleared state and locals to begin to participate in the website. I think right now we have about 200 users. What's happening that in the middle of our initiatives to expand HISN is that HISN is going through a redevelopment. It's going through, I don't know what the right IT term is, but it's being redesigned. And so it'll be HISN 3. And HISN 3 should have enhanced capability, enhanced security, more efficient webinar capabilities. I think it's supposed to be easier to log on. And our web page is going to transition in early August. So we've reached out to the Fusion Centers to give us their cleared employees. We certainly have a record of their cleared employees. What we don't have is their email addresses. So we're reaching out to the fusion centers to get lists of their cleared employees and their email addresses. And once we transition to HISN 3, we're going to start inviting those cleared members, those non-security liaison folks, to join us on HISN 3. I think we have about 700 names now that we won't invite till we move into that new web portal. The other things that we are looking at HISN 3 is we can post training up there, and that training can be tracked. So we are able to, or we should be able to, have people take mandatory training and be able to track their participation. We still want security liaisons to give training. We think personal training is the best way to go, but there are cleared people who are not associated with fusion centers, who are at alternate locations, who are not the responsibility of the security liaison. So we're looking at means to expand this capability and to move out. And
just a quick comment on that. I mean, yeah. We have a very robust group of cleared folks who have nothing to do with fusion centers. We get clearances for all of our regional health department folks that are working on potential bioterrorism issues. We've got clearances for all of our technology folks that operate the entire state technology infrastructure that deal with threat issues. We've got clearances for folks working on evacuation planning for the National Capital Region. I mean, lots and lots of folks that have nothing to do with fusion centers.
Right.
So what we do, the fusion center has a security liaison, and I have a POC in my office that has sort of oversight over everybody else that's not in the fusion center world, and we make sure that they're up to date on training and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But that really needs to be formalized more
right.
with DHS, because
yeah.
the focus always has been the fusion centers, and
right.
yet that's
and,
not...
Mm-hmm. And I think we're well positioned to expand out beyond the... You know, we were kind of overwhelmed with trying to get this program stood up, and the fusion centers are the biggest, most
yeah.
robust classified footprint that the federal government has out there. But you're right. We have an obligation to work with you all, the Homeland Security advisors and the governor's offices. And the lessons learned, you know, some of these webinars and teleconferences, we can certainly expand out. I've mentioned it to Elena, and we need to do it. We are prepared to do it. So we'll work with Elena and you. And I've said this at previous meetings, I know, so I'm
we're
on
making,
the hook.
We're making progress.
But,
progress.
We really focused on getting the compliance reviews up and getting them done and getting all the protocols in place. But we're certainly well positioned to expand out beyond the fusion centers now. We're comfortable. We did two or three pilots, and we have 16 under our belt now. There's still up to 72 fusion centers out there. So we've made a significant dent, and we actually feel kind of comfortable that the ones we visited are pretty well managed, and they take security seriously, which is what we thought, but it's nice to know. So
it's all good information, Charlie, and everyone, I think, appreciates it. Part of why I was asking the question with the sharing and even beyond classified is because, obviously it's important. We had an incident, you know, the marathon in Boston in May, and, you know, obviously you can go back and Monday morning quarterback it, and that's not what we're here to do, but there was back and forth. The Boston police chief said his office didn't have the information about the ongoings and the whereabouts of the two suspects, well, one deceased at this point, going to Russia and so on and so forth. So, you know, I just think it's important for all of us, even beyond this committee, and certainly this committee has a lot of involvement in this area, to be evaluating the intensity, the effectiveness of the sharing, you know, in this case, particularly at the local level of information, both classified and unclassified.
Yeah. Well, I think Tasha, you provided me with a statistic that up to 400 Intel analysts participated in HISN, and not our portal, but in HISN after the Boston bombing. So there was a lot of interaction on the HISN portal trying to assist in that. So.
Sure.
I'll give you. I have a couple more updates to give you, and then I'll I'll let you go. A while ago, I think it was about a year ago, we gave you two secure forms to look at. One is a private sector acknowledgement form to be given to individuals who from the private sector who are granted clearances outside the NISPOM, and that form was to inform them of their responsibilities, that their clearance was associated with them and not their company. And the other is a form that was to be signed by senior personnel who are responsible for locations, such as Fusion Center directors, that they accept. Well, we took your all's edits. We got it into the DHS forms process. We got a nice, pretty form design. At the final step, we were told to send it back to General Counsel. I just got General Counsel's comments back. I don't want to offend any attorneys, but attorneys like to improve things. So we got a lot of cosmetic edits that we are not required to do. We're not required to do the cosmetic edits. But they identified in both forms edits that they consider to be legally required. So I'm going to try and reformat these forms, highlight the legally required edits, hopefully get it back to the PAC for a quick concurrence. I mean, if you all end up rewriting it again, then we'll end up having to go back. But I'll highlight what our legal counsel has stated needs to be changed or needs to be inserted. And I'll send it back to this body. Hopefully we can get whatever concerns or edits you have, and we'll get it back to General Counsel and see if we can't get it approved and published. So that's pretty much the current news. I always want to tell you about my division and that we're authorized 20 people. We have 14 people. We were supposed to get a couple of IT positions to help us with the CVS database, to help us with the HISN website. We interviewed people, but we didn't get anyone, and then a hiring freeze took place. And so we're short a couple of field security coordinators. We don't have the IT folks we were promised. It appears that the hiring freeze is being slowly lifted, so there's no floodgates open, but hopefully we'll be able to hire more people. So we know we have more to do. We're working diligently to get it done. We're hoping to get more people so that we can get more expertise focused on the CVS and the HISN site. That's where we are. And I'll go ahead, Carol.
I just have a question. When you said that there was a high turnover rate at Fusion Center, you said that security days on staff were and was there another position, and do you have any idea as to why the high turnover rate?
Well, I know the Fusion Center directors, I think there's like, I may be wrong. I think there's a 30% turnover rate for them, but I don't know the reason.
It's probably just career paths. I mean, These are generally state troopers, state police, and so you would do a rotation, and then if you're promotable, you want to move to the next responsible position so that you can continue to be promoted up.
And a lot of the security liaisons are law enforcement people. We've told some states thought they had to appoint a law enforcement person, and we tried to educate them and said, you can appoint a state employee that is going to be there long term. It does not have to be. But the fusion centers have a large law enforcement, or most, a lot of them do, have a large law enforcement footprint. Some of them come under the state police. We're working with what we have, and there are places that have long-term. I think Fred is long-term.
Yeah, Fred's, and he's VDEM. He's the Virginia Department of Emergency Management. Our Fusion Center is co-managed between the Department of Emergency Management and the state police, and so we have both employees from both agencies in there, and he's a Virginia Department of Emergency Management.
Right. So we have some places.
The director is a state police officer.
State police, yeah. So, but we have some security liaisons that are detectives, and, they rotate in and out. So,
You will also find that, unfortunately, state pay rates are not comparable to federal pay rates. So oftentimes our folks come in, they get trained, they get cleared. Most of them also get the FBI, clearance levels and poly. And so all of a sudden, they're very, very marketable on the federal side to higher paying jobs, and we lose them to you guys. So please stop poaching.
So. Is there any other questions?
No?
Thank you, Charlie.
Okay. So we're at the point of the agenda where we have an open forum discussion, and anyone, both on the telephone as well, are welcome to chime in if you have some points you wanted to raise. So now is the time for that. Anyone? I see in the back. Yes, Homero. This is Homero Navarro from ISU. I think you have something to hand out.
Yes. Okay, good. I'm done. Yes, it's the ISU annual report to hand out to everyone. And I also had a question for Charlie. Now, in the time I've been here with the SLTPS PAC, there's always been the big emphasis on cybersecurity, international terrorism. But statistically, the U.S. experiences environmental terrorism every year, which in effect costs the taxpayers quite a bit of money. But it's never been mentioned in SLTPS or any type of training, any type of focus on environmental terrorism. And as I said, statistically, it's happening this year, it happened last year. So every year experiences some form of environmental terrorism, but yet I haven't heard anything of it here in this committee.
I'm not sure who manages it. I'd have to look into it if we wanted a guest speaker.
Yeah.
We've in Virginia, our Fusion Center actually has developed a number of products on environmental terrorism. And, you know, it tends to be more of a domestic focus. It's a domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Without the same influences from international actors. I guess sometimes it is, but oftentimes it's not. So that might be one of the reasons we don't hear about it here. But, you know, Virginia's Fusion Center, Charlie, you wanted to reach out to Lee Miller. I mean, they've developed product on that and done PowerPoints and could certainly, you know, provide some information on what we have.
I mention this because the impetus is homeland security, mm-hmm. and whether it's domestic or international. Environmental affects Virginia as much as likely as California, Nevada, Utah, every single state. So in terms of sharing, I was
sure.
Like environmental groups operate in certain, I mean, at this point, they're not locally based. I mean, they have a structure that's going to be across the nation, if not regional.
Point
so
well
that's
taken.
Why
there's a clear connection to homeland security, and if it's at the intensity level that you mentioned, that's worthwhile to pursue.
I mean, I say this, and not mention because it's not, I mean, how many people really concern themselves with somebody chaining themselves to a tree? But overall, the impact financially cost taxpayers is more. It's incremental. It keeps going up and up each year. It's like whether they destroy like some kind of refinery, oil refinery, or whatnot. But obviously, it doesn't
Absolutely.
Attract attention as it does if somebody strapping bombs to themselves and blowing themselves up.
Yeah, I'll see if there's someone at DHS or the Fusion Center who could address it.
I'd like to comment on that. Actually, there are products that have come out through the normal distribution channel about environmental terrorism, environmental activism, and so forth. So it's not that it's handled separately. It's just incorporated within the products that are put out. So I've noticed a trend over the last few years where this drumbeat of cyber has been finally come to fruition, and it's in everybody's vocabulary now. But the environmental piece of that has been just part of the normal law enforcement and
right.
and other communication process. So it's I don't think anybody saw that it was necessary to have a separate chain on that. It's just incorporated into the normal items.
Mm-hmm. As it plays into various critical infrastructure components,
right?
Because it could cross many, for sure.
Yeah.
Chemical and physical infrastructure and all sorts of things. Okay.
Good point.
Yep. Good point. Anybody else? Telephone folks, you still there?
Still here. Nothing. Just calling with Intergov. I know I have a couple things to follow up with Charlie on, and Charlie already sent you the two letters for the Mark as well as the NGA legislative alert.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. All right, then, moving to our, we're at the end of the meeting, so appreciate everybody's participation. The briefings we had, I thought, were very useful. And just our next meetings, we have scheduled for January 24th, 2014, here and we'll, of course, make use of the teleconference because the budget situation is not going to get better, unfortunately. Then we have a tentative meeting for next July 23rd, also here. So with that, we'll adjourn the meeting unless there's any other comments.
Just
anyone?
One quick comment. I term out with the governor January 11th, so since the next meeting is January 24th, you might want to go ahead and start working on the new STMPS vice chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Terry. And
all right.
Appreciate you know, ahead.
You're welcome to come back so we can acknowledge your service. Yes. You've been very instrumental in providing a lot of input, as everyone here knows.
It's been fun. It's been fun. I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Thanks, everyone. Good day. I'm going to sign off here on the phone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Done some.
Oh, no.
We have. Oh. To say that.